My name is Dale Soden, professor of history and director of the Weyerhaeuser Center for Christian Faith and Learning, sponsor for tonight's lecture. We are thrilled that you have come to hear one of the best known historians of religion in the United States, Martin Marty. I need to extend a special thanks to the bishop of the Lutheran Church in the Eastern Washington, Idaho Synod, Martin Wells. He's been instrumental in helping us bring Martin Marty here, who will be with the Synod this weekend. So thanks to you, Martin. I've asked my longtime friend and colleague, Jerry Sitzer, from Whitworth's Department of Theology to introduce Dr. Marty tonight, because many of you probably do not know that Jerry was a student of Dr. Marty and did his dissertation under Martin many years ago at the University of Chicago. You know Jerry through his writings, A Grace Disguised, and his most recent book, Water from a Deep Well, but probably many of you do not know that he has written a great book on religion in the Second World War, A Cautious Patriotism. So it's a great opportunity for us to tell you all what a great influence Jerry has been, and now an opportunity for him to thank his mentor and introduce him. So Jerry, would you come up and introduce the teacher?
Thank you, Dale. Well, Dr. Marty has written lots of books. If I were to read his resume, it would take here probably 2 or 3 hours. I'm not going to do that, over 50 books. He has also written a column in the Christian Century that has gone for almost 60 years. He has been the editor of Context, a newsletter, for about 40 years. He travels around the world. He's read everything. He knows everyone. What more can you say? Well, actually, I can say something a little bit more. It really was a privilege for me to be his student at the University of Chicago from 85 to 89. And I got to know him fairly well during those years, and we've kept in touch since then. He is fiercely loyal to his students. In fact, he carries pictures around of his students. I know that he prays for his students regularly, and that means a great deal, not only to me, but to the other students who studied under him. I think the impulse behind Marty that's been so significant over the years is his ability to be committed to the faith, the Christian faith, especially in its Lutheran expression, but also faith in general. He's able to walk this fine line between a loyalty to a tradition and loyalty to the way that faith plays out in the public sphere, religion and public life. He's written about this a lot, and he's embodied it in his own life. And I have a great deal of appreciation for that. He's able to relate to people across a wide spectrum, many different faith communities or non-faith communities, and yet stay anchored in his own tradition. That's been a great example to me and many others as well. The other thing is his ability to be personal. He loves his students. He's loved his students over the years. When I was at the University of Chicago, my late wife Linda was a musician, and his wife Harriet is too. And on occasion, Linda and I, with our two young children, David was 1, 2, and 3 at the time, Catherine just a year or two older, we'd go to his house at Riverside, and the two women would do music in the parlor, and Marty and I would take my two kids for walks and just talk. That was a wonderful memory I have. After Linda died, he was one of the first people to call me on the telephone and to provide pastoral care. And that means more to me than words could ever express. It's an honor to introduce you. Thank you.
My first words to you, dear friends, are Goethe's last words, Mehr Licht. We're going to have a little more light. We give you an outline, and then you won't be able to see it otherwise. Meanwhile, while that's going on, before we get to the outline and the formal talk, they always say a speaker should chat a bit to test the microphone and let you know what she or he is like, and trivia. And my wife says, that's a high risk with you, Marty, because they'll never know when the trivia ends and the talk starts. Bright enough to see if you want to see, okay? Good. Dear friends, and I really appreciate that introduction. It's moving to my heart and my mind. We at Chicago like to say we make house calls, and we like to come back and see how former students are doing. And Professor Sitzer is, of course, nationally known for what he does, but it's nice to make a house call and see him with some of his students in action. I like to say that you can write books and they go out of print, but your students have students who have students, and that's where we all came from, and that's what's going to be going on from there. And I was given a choice of what to talk about, but they picked up from I have a new book out called The Christian World, A Global History. This is not what is in that book. I don't like to repeat myself. When I was a pastor, I had three services every Sunday, and the third sermon, I was pretty bored already by my own sermon. So I'm not going to repeat what's in the book, but I'm going to do my own version, something tonight. But I do have a theme when I teach different perspectives on history. Well, how can you talk about Christianity globally and locally? And my image comes from hurricane watching. I'm a prairie kid, so I've never seen a hurricane. I've seen tornadoes. But I am an expert on hurricane watching. My dentist's office had a popular science on hurricane watching, and I read that. And from other sources deduced, but I once read a book in which somebody said, all the great sociologists of religion, Emil Durkheim, Max Weber, and so on, viewed the hurricane of modernity, the challenge to religion, viewed the hurricane of modernity from its very eye, which was the safest place to be. And I thought that was a very strange concept. We hear people say, oh, I was in the eye of the hurricane. Safe place to be. Why? Well, there are four advantages to hurricane watching, and the first and the fourth will be what this is about tonight. First is from a satellite angle, 30,000 miles up, and you get a certain kind of knowledge that is very important. It's a beautiful silver ribbon on the screen on television as you watch it, but it gives you a knowledge that maybe it's heading for Galveston and maybe it's heading for North Carolina, and you have several days head start. Very important. And when you talk about global Christianity, you almost have to step back that far because you're talking about 2 billion people through two millennia. The second level is where those sociologists of religion were. The safest place to be, the eye of the hurricane, that's where the C-130s fly, the meteorological planes. They have all the scientific equipment you could want. We've never lost one of them because if the winds change, it changes. If it's higher, lower, east, west, or whatever, perfectly safe. You sound like you're in the real middle of things and you're safe. We call that academic tenure. The third level, and I will be with some of them in the next 2 days when the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America Synod meets, are pastors, teachers, deacons and deaconesses, nurses, lay ministers, etc. I compare them in hurricaneology to the bridge tenders. If you're at an island offshore that's connected by a bridge and a hurricane is coming, Hilton Head or wherever, the bridge tender cannot leave ethically. Nor can the radio people, the media people, the pastors, the medical technology people. It's immoral. In the Middle Ages, there was almost no worse sin for a cleric than to leave town when the plague came. And that's bridge tenders of what I compare to the professionals who know everything that the satellite and the plane did. And then the fourth level, and that's what the local means here, is the people who are in the path of it, in their huts, or mansions for that matter, on the Carolina coast, Texas coast, where all of these forces come upon them and relate to the others. So I'm going to connect the global and the locals, and I call it tonight a global local faith and a local global faith. The year before apartheid changed, I was spending 6 weeks teaching in Cape Town, and I would preach every week in the townships, a governmentally provided very poor housing in colored and black communities. And at one of these, I spent a whole day. My wife was a musician, as you've heard, and we found that Lucas, their pianist, had come to Jesus. He was an old jazz pianist. And she and he did a few rips while we're getting going. And then the pastor would sing a line, and he would play a line, and the congregation would sing. They couldn't afford hymn books or anything like that. And then we were taken to home where there were six young men. They had not eaten anything but potatoes since Thursday, and this was Sunday, and they served us tea and cookies, which the pastor and his wife had subsidized. We went back for the afternoon service, and at the end of the day, I just said, "This is one of the most spiritually moving days in my wife's and my life. You've done so much for us. What can we do in return for you?" And they said, "Just what you do every week anyhow. Pray for us." Were they that vivid to us? Ever since, I've always tried to keep in mind some other part of the world during our intercessions, because it's so easy to have access, as I'll try to say a little later in a part on nomadism of today. There's an evening hymn that we taught them at the time to say how we thought of them. And I print two lines of them on your program in italics. Middle of an evening hymn. "We thank you that your church unsleeping, while earth rolls onward into light, through all the world its watch is keeping, and never rests by day or night. As the globe turns, the church wakes up in another part and sings the praises, and there's never a time when that isn't going on. And when you're in a desolate place, it means so much to know that's going on somewhere else." We'll have an ornery little text, I call it, to back this up. An Anglican theologian, Martin Thornton, deals with the gospel stories in which, for example, the woman wants Jesus to help her, but she's a Syrian and he's not paying attention to her. He's going on back to the disciples, back to the Jews. And Martin Thornton says, quote, and if you had a yellow marker, you could yellow mark this line, "Jesus restricts 9/10 of his ministry to 12 Hebrews because it's the only way to redeem all the Americans." Or Botswanians or anywhere else. Going deep, caring profoundly, in that highly localized, provincial, people in their huts and their mansions place, in order to be poised for what today we know in a greater realization than anyone could ever have known before, globalism. In picking the title, I didn't know whether to go with the cliche version of think globally, act locally. And so I did what profound researchers do these days. I punched Google, and I put in both versions of the phrase, and think globally, act locally got 285,000 search engine hits, and think locally, act globally only 10,400. And tonight I'm going to hit that undercompensated version and say we need more from the local to think of the global. And how do we do this? Well, first of all, just awareness of globe. It's inconceivably different from what it was just a few years ago. And you get this, I think, by any version of staying alert to the larger world. Karl Barth, one of the greatest theologians of the last century, Swiss-German theologian, is always quoted for having said that everyone, every Christian, but certainly every preacher or teacher, should do everything with one Bible in one hand and newspaper in the other. Well, I thought I better look up once now whether he really did say that. I like to collect things that people would have said if they'd known how much we wanted them to have said it. Martin Luther is said to have said, "Better be ruled by a smart Turk than a dumb Christian." And it fit his theology, but you can't find it in 110 volumes, and you can't find it in the Google era either. I don't think anybody really thinks that St. Francis wrote the prayer of St. Francis, but it is so Franciscan. So I want to check on Karl Barth. Yeah, he did say this. The pastor and the faithful should not deceive themselves into thinking that they are a religious society which has to do with certain themes. They live in a world we still need, according to my old formulation, the Bible and the newspaper. Before I found that, I'd gone to press with your outline, and I found a much more less elegant version. It says, who but a bad translator could translate bad German worse? Reading of all forms of outspokenly secular literature, the newspaper above all, is urgently recommended for understanding the Epistle to the Romans, etc. It loses in translation. Lektüre von allerhand ausgesprochen weltlicher Literatur, Zeitung für alle mit zum Verständnis, Römerbrief dringend zu empfehlen. Now you got it straight. But if I spent a little extra time on it, there was a purpose. It's to say that as we think globally and locally, in the era when globalization as a secular and an economic form is a reality that's palpable and close to us, it's very important for us to see the religious and for us the Christian implications from our local scene, participating locally, thinking globally. So what I did just for fun a couple of days ago, I took this week's issue of The Economist. It's the remaining news magazine, now the time of Newsweek do silly stuff every week. Economist is still news all the way through. I recommend it. And just flipping through, every time religion came up, and it's in bold print here, and I'm just going to shoot past it and just say, how can we not be involved with God's larger world? The main story, three pages on the Olympic torch, and you have religion in Tibet, Myanmar, Buddhist monks featured, Catholics in Pennsylvania vote. The Pope hadn't yet come, but he is going to make news too, you notice. The Sunnis and Shias in Iraq, nice to know the difference between them, something that Donald Rumsfeld didn't when he started the war. The Texas polygamy raid, very complex church-state issues. China, Gansu province, Buddhist monks, and Xinjiang, Muslim women, and a palm bombing at a mosque. Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood and the elections. Jerusalem and Israel for Jews debate. And the J Street, K Street is lobby, and J Street is the Jewish lobby argument. Saxony-Anhalt, the cradle of the Reformation, German soldiers, and they're in the Hindu Kush area, India, Delhi, and Kenya, Nairobi, and the Islamic past, Muslim women in finance in the Middle East, an art show on Babylon and Babylonian art, and Rome and Luther, and what Luther thought Rome was Babylon, a book on Between Allah and America, Israeli fiction and Jews, Israel cleansing, and the death of Charlton Heston, alias Moses. Just to run that screen before you might say that whether you're doing it from internet news, TV, radio, newspaper, or any other archaic form, you're likely to have to run into all these proper nouns in all these places, and everywhere religion is bonded with it. And in most places, Christianity is with it. The world today has 6.6 billion people and 2.2 billion people named after Jesus Christ, 33%, the same as it was a century ago. The Muslim world, every fifth person in the world is Muslim. In 1950, every seventh was. Buddhism and Hinduism alive. Christianity under the surfaces coming up in China. The Enlightenment 2 centuries ago, out of which our modern universities grew and for which we owe a lot, including the U.S. Constitution, was written by people who thought that religion would always wane. The more you studied the sciences and the arts, the more it would disappear. And it often did from curricula and from the media. And in some parts of the world, and we turn around and it's all over globally. And we're busy trying to catch up. Western Europe is the only place in the world that I know of where religion is really, really radically declining. And we are, in so many ways, most of us heirs of it, that we sort of instinctively got that understanding. That's what's going on. Church attendance. Pope Benedict XVI will come to a nation where 40% of the Catholics were in church last Sunday. You go back to Italy, where 9% are. You go to Spain, the most Catholic country, where 6% are. Church of England on Easter morning is 4%. In case you think this Lutheran is harder than everybody else, go to Sweden. My wife and I See, in Sweden, it's minus 2% church attendance. And I call that little area of the world, we're going global now, starts west of Poland, is Western Europe, the British Isles, I used to say except for Ireland, but now Ireland's in it, Canada, much of the northern U.S., across to Japan, and you in the Northwest certainly know about this, and I call it the spiritual ice belt. It's not in touch with all the rest, and yet it is the place where all the signals come, and where political and economic and military address is given to it, and Christian understandings in a huge way. We're not out of it. In the last 24 hours in that spiritual ice belt, there are now 3,000 fewer nominal Christians. In sub-Saharan Africa alone, despite wars and famines and AIDS and plagues, there are 18,000 more every 24 hours. So we better pay attention to a little bit of what's going on there along the way. And I'm not saying we don't, but I'm just saying that we have to put more energy into it than ever before. In that same issue, The Economist, I had extra time, and my outline promises that I will say something about it, but I hadn't had time to do it yet, but I now have the latest research. And if you get the latest issue of The Economist, you'll find an 18-page section that really talks about huge psychic differences that are occurring in the latest stage of the technological revolutions. Terms that we have a hard time keeping up on. I learned a great deal from reading it, and while I depend on my own children and grandchildren to translate all this for me, and students and so on, it begins to dawn on us. If you want to know a little bit about what age has to do with the nomadism, not living everywhere and living everywhere, they had a little graph here in which they take people between ages of 18 and 29 and then over 65. What percentage of them do the following? For example, how many do text messages? 85% of the young group, 11% of the older. How many take pictures with their 82 down to 22? Play games, 47, 6. You'd think we in senior citizen homes would at least find that as an inexpensive way to have fun, but I'm glad we don't. Getting your music through at 38%, my age group, 2%. Email, 28%, gotten through these handheld devices, 6%. Oh, all one or another of them all, 96% of people aged 18 to 29 are doing handheld versions of this, and 36% of the older. So there's a lot of catching up we probably have to do on the way global and local interact somehow in cyberspace. And they told me there is no space in cyberspace. I never quite got that. For me, everything has to have a where, but W-H-E-R-E. No. And the new word for this, originally we thought was going to be techno-Bedouins, like the Bedouin people in the Middle East, where they're tents and they move and move and move, or the Gypsy Spirit Missions, they were sometimes called. But that is obsolete. You don't have to have a place anymore. All you have to have is connectivity. I'm not going to speak critically of this. I'm just going to report that it's here, and I hope some Whitworth students are figuring out all the Christian implications of what it means when global and local are, in a sense, absolutely fused. One of the things that the authors of this report point to is a paradox that now that you can reach anywhere in the globe, most of the transactions are pulling you more local. Family ties grow. I like to listen when I'm on an airplane, people going by. They left somebody in the parking lot 2 minutes earlier. No, I'm walking past row 18C. Now it's now 18J. Well, okay, now 18J. Well, you're staying in touch. I love you. Still love you. Okay. The downside is strangers are more remote. On average, the handheld, people have 80% of the calls go to 4 or 5 different people. That's about it. It's usually your co-workers. You have virtual firms. You seek a third place. You had the company place and home. The third place would be Starbucks or such a place where everything has to be Wi-Fi and so on, because you're connected with that larger world. On downsides, face-to-face disappears in the company, in the transactions, or whatever. Disturbing to me, because I really believe strongly that the Christian gospel calls us to face-to-face relations. That's my first critical view of any of this. On the other hand, it really does wonders. I have a granddaughter in Hyderabad, India, and we could talk to her several times a week. Her brother is in Australia, college sophomore. We do that. I have a grandson in Yemen, a nephew in Barcelona. But that's several days ago. They're all different places now. And they and their parents and we are in touch and not missing anything. Except face-to-face, of course, which is a big part of what is at the best of local life. There are many reports of the difference. The physical presence of the other human being becomes less important. Family is strong, and they make a distinction between strong ties and weak ties. Well, there are also sections that are irrelevant to tonight's talk, but I can't resist them. Etiquette, if you're a techno-Bedouin. How loud do you talk in restaurants and so on? Linguistic whatever, whole new languages are developing. If you've ever tried to read text message from a student to another student and try to figure out what it was, you'll know something I don't know. I think, like all breakthroughs, like the technological, God can be at work and wonderful things can happen, and we can also see there's a downside which we have to face along the way. So the global and the local might mean that we see the rest of the world, those Hindus, those Buddhists, those Muslims, those other than we are, in negative terms, even though we can reach them like we never could have before, and local we confirm our prejudices. But the Christian church can do something about this and is well poised to do other things about it. So at the bottom of the page, I have a paragraph which I call The Poise and Potential of Christian People in the Era of Nomadism. Robin McNeil and Jim Lehrer, the McNeil-Lehrer Report people, while only Jim Lehrer is on the program, have a foundation. And the purpose of that foundation is to bring people together to try to ask, are there better ways that we can get the American public through television, radio, travel, commerce, or whatever, more aware of what it really is like to be somewhere else and to be someone else? Which is a pretty good definition, by the way, of what the humanities do at a college like this, university. I'm getting relief. That's the local in action. Face to face, folks. Thank you. I've had too much fun with faculty and students today and talked too much, so it's got to disappear. They bring them together, and at a resort on the eastern shore of Maryland, several years ago, I was one of the 60. On precisely this topic, and they have very high-powered people there, Madeleine Albright, Lauren Eagleburger. My captain, they break us into eights, was Paul Gigot, the Journal, Wall Street Journal, editorial page editor. My wife and I read four newspapers every morning, and Wall Street Journal is one of them, and we agree that they have the best news reporting of any newspaper, and to our taste, the worst editorials. And I said to Mr. Gigot, how do you work that? We don't read them, and they don't read us under one roof. And they went through several days on how they can do this, and there were only two of us from the religious world, Nathan Wright, who was then canon of the Washington National Cathedral, and I. And over lunch, he said, why don't we bring up religion? Well, yeah, okay. Who has more potential to know about other parts of the world than Christians in America, all of whom have missionary connections, and almost every congregation has their twin in the Philippine Islands or in Africa, and they learn from them as well as talk to them, and their kids go off on ventures in them, and you get the letters and all these forms of communication, and like my South Africans say, you pray for these other parts of the world. And so we brought it up, and the whole thing was transformed suddenly. It hadn't occurred to them that this was a body of people that is the largest organizational network in the world, in more nations, more diverse ways, more languages, more everything. Now, we don't, from that, come out and start bragging about all we're doing. We're talking about a potential. Think what we can do by exploiting these things and recognizing, therefore, theologically, what the church claims to be. Colossians 1:17, the world is created in and through and for Christ, and in Christ all things hold together. It surely didn't look that way at the congregation of Colossae, and it doesn't look that way to us today, what is held together, but the eye of faith says it is that. And that's the satellite view, that the whole body of Christ and the whole church and the whole globe is already part of the term I read from the magazine, connectivity. So what I'm going to do with my remaining time now is throw out just a variety of things. They are connected, but they're not in a particular sequence, which I hope will prompt some discussion at the end of my talk, and maybe that you take the outline with you and pick up from there. In no particular order. Number one, as Christianity moves south, what does this mean for the depleted North, as in that spiritual ice belt? When you hear that the northern world lost 3,000 in 24 hours, and one part of the southern world gained 18,000. What do you do? Well, on one level, you could just say, oh, yeah, statistics. If I'd said we lost 4,000 and they gained 90,000, you'd say, oh, dude, that's a lot. You know, okay, that's it. Because we can't really deal with those numbers until you think about what that gap does mean. Should we be envious? Boy, aren't they fortunate they're getting all this. Well, I don't know whether we'd like to trade places with them. We might trade joy in the gospel and the gift of thanksgiving with them, because every little thing is likely to prompt more thanksgiving than it happens in a culture where so many goods are accepted. So should we be envious of them? Should we be resentful because most of them are picking up forms of Christianity which aren't quite what we are or were? The huge growth in Africa is Pentecostal. And some of you are Pentecostal, and we have Pentecostals, but it is also very different, upsetting from a standard Christian thing. Years ago, in the 70s, I was in Bogota, where Professor Wright's sister's daughter is, Bogota, Colombia. And at the Christian Century magazine, it was a liberal Protestant magazine, we were always told, the worst country in the world is Spain, except for Colombia. They're run by Catholics, they're totalitarian, there's no freedom, there's no nothing, and there's no gospel, and if you're a Protestant, you're not safe. And here I am in Bogota. In the cathedral square, where Archbishop Ruben Isaza was blessing two men, two women, two, one Roman Catholic, one evangelical or Pentecostal or mainline Protestant, were to go up into the villages together and distribute medicines and New Testaments. Something new is going on there. So, Pentecostalism changes us, and we change it. Do we glory in it? Triumph? Hooray for our side? When we know how frail much of this is, we're a little careful about that. Does it inspire curiosity? What's their secret? What in their lives does it touch? It doesn't seem to touch as much our lives. So, as it moves south, what does it mean for the vision, the angle of vision of people who locally measure from their own? The Germans have a word for a kind of people in my profession. I'm a church historian. Kirchturmgeschichte. You write the history of the church from what you can see from your church tower. So if you get a book in America from somebody in a part of the culture where megachurches grow, you think they write books about the success of it all? And, wow, man, that's something. I was a pastor once right next to O'Hare Field where there were no people. 7 years later when I left, there were 30,000 people, and 1,000 of them were in my church, and they said, man, you're a hot shot. I didn't work nearly as hard as I did on four inner-city churches during my doctoral student years, and we didn't grow at all where we were, Kirchturmgeschichte. I can't resist a little story here. When you're a graduate student in theology and you are an ordained minister, and this is 1954, and you can make $35 a week by preaching a sermon, that's the groceries for the week. So I would pretty well preach anywhere that they would send me. And I'd been preaching to a black church for a couple of years, and they got a new pastor. And I got a phone call from somebody who says, now, would you preach at St. Peter's Church, 74th in Michigan? It's a middle-class, lower-middle-class Lutheran parish, and middle-class blacks are moving in, a lot of doctors and so on, but we can't integrate them. So the district is going to take it over, and would you preach there for 6 weeks? I said, only on one set of terms. If I can preach in the effort to get them to revoke that vote that they'd taken. The vote, by the way, was 83-2. Yeah, okay. And, you know, I really believed I could change them. I mean, I had Amos on my side. Jesus, I mean, how can you miss? And then they said, you do preach German, don't you? No. But that $35 a week was sort of worth it. And so I said, I could hold the liturgy in German and then preach in English. And I thought, they'll never see me again. Why don't I do it? So once in my life, I preached 6 sermons in German. Actually, I memorized Ernst Turnhausen's Philipper Brief, Ausgelegt für die Gemeinde. He was a Reformed Swiss, and every time he would say, unser Zwingli sagt, or Zwingli says, I would say, unser Luther sagt. And it worked all right on Philippians. And after the 6 weeks, they voted. Remember, it had been 83-2, and the new vote was 85-3. And I said, I got a 50% increase, and you got about 4% increase. Driving home, I didn't have a car, and the man driving home, looking over the shoulder, says, you know, Pastor, you think it's the Germans that are holding this church together. You couldn't be more wrong. We're Austrian. So, the limits you can resolve, you can't make all the moves. We are in pockets, various ways, a long way. Number 2, when you hear that growth, it's very easy to be romantic about the growth. When I'm in South Africa or Bogota or anywhere where you experience this kind of growth, you just come back full of zest and energy and wondering why it can't be happening everywhere, without looking at the fact that there is also great fragility. A lot of the success in Africa is the gospel of health and wealth, which is a gospel that is very hard to square with the 4 gospels that we've had. You believe this, you'll give that, and God will pour things on you. The largest Christian church in the world is Pastor Cho's in South Korea, 250,000 members, every service held in a stadium. And it is very much in that mode. It is Korean Presbyterian fused with Korean shamanism with a little sense of the lottery. I had a former student who wrote this story in which he says, Cho will say, if you have a $16,000 debt, don't pray for $15,000. Pay for $16,000. That's what God will give you. And then will anybody in the stadium raise their hand if that's happened this week? And a few hundred people have had good stuff happen. So you all figure that's it. There's a lot of that, and I think it's an extremely thin, not very durable thing when the hard times come back, as they do anywhere. So I don't think you should romanticize everything that goes on elsewhere. You have to get close and notice that the same things that are troublesome anywhere are everywhere. So we have to ask questions, are we building well? And I'm really enjoying the transactions that go on, again, often by the church body leadership, but by all the men and women who volunteer there, by all the clergy who come with sabbaticals to the northern world or whatever, and we can learn the limits of what's happening, but we also can learn of the glories. So we de-romanticize it. Just because they're growing doesn't mean that that's always gospel, but it does give you a very fertile field for the gospel. 3. What does or should trickle up from the poor world, the southern world, and the eastern world worship? Philip Jenkins of Pennsylvania State University is probably the foremost scholar on writing about poor world and rich world. And he makes a great point of all the ways in which the southern world, I'm calling it that, the poor world, will be influencing us. And it shows up, for example, in worship. I often attend African-American churches, which are really of African rootage and tied to African worship, whether it's Ethiopian or Kenyan or whatever. Many of you know about that. And it's very different from what I'd known along the way. But it trickles in. The new hymn books of Presbyterians and Methodists and Lutherans and so on show some evidence that they've been listening to these other tempi and beats and harmonies and sing them. I was a member of a relatively high church, Lutheran church, for 43 years. And not a big church, but a wonderful organist, cantor we call him. Came home one Easter. We follow exactly the Lutheran liturgy. And I said to my wife, did you notice today Randy started out with Christ Lag and Todes Banden, a prelude from Bach's Great Easter, Christ lay a death storm. Before the morning was over, we had done a Nicaraguan chant, a South African chant, a hymn from the ancient church, etc., etc. All these fit, but because there was a coherence as to what the texts were about and good planning, all these were together, and they've changed our way. And when I hear the members going home, they're often singing the last beat of that last rouser. But also, it happens a lot of other ways, in theology itself. I have a Catholic friend who says, when you're dealing with Africa, subcontinent of Asia, today's Latin America with its many changes, the big difference is, whether you know it or not, almost every Catholic church and most Protestant churches should really have two statues out in front, one of Plato and one of Aristotle. Because we don't realize how much of that has gotten into the way we look at things. A sample. One of the doctrines that we Platonists have is the unchangeability of God, right? Well, the unchangeability of God. Now read your Bible. I'm a Bible believer. Read your Bible and look for the unchangeability of God. There's a split second in the book of James when it says, with God there is no shadow due to turning. I think Malachi has part of a verse, but that's barely made it into the Hebrew scriptures. All the other times, God creates. Can you create without changing? Are you the same before you baked something or had a child or did something? It repented the Lord that he had done so and so. Now, if he's going to smash Israel to nothing and then changes his mind and saves them, that's change. That's wonderful. And it's change when the eternal takes on the conditions of humanity in Jesus. That's change. How did we get unchangeability? By the way, I'm not summoning great courage to try to sound like a heretic here, because this is kind of marginal among Christian doctrines. But it's there, so while we're house cleaning, let's bring it back in. How did we get it? Plato. What are you saving up the word God for if you mean something less than the perfect? That's what Plato would say. Perfect, God, God, perfect. Now, once you've had that, if there's change, it would have to be change to imperfect. You can't have that. Well, let's take a little human analogy. Suppose there's some people here tonight, and I think there are some, and I hope so, who say, we have a perfect marriage. The last thing they meant is it's unchanging. Oh, no, it's dynamic. It alters in the light of new circumstances. Family grows. There's a marriage in the family. Vicissitudes come. Joy comes or whatever. And, of course, you are that same basic gene pool, DNA, fabric. You've had particular experiences and continuity, I hope, all that. And still the delight of the perfection is in the change. Okay. We get into trouble, therefore, by posing a problem in a certain way. And we have to get a non-biblical solution to a problem that the Bible doesn't even set up. Because our God is active among us constantly. That's just one little sample of what reimagining biblical Christianity is. My late colleague Joseph Sittler, a great blind 80-year-old theologian, said when he would do things ecumenical, anywhere in the world he went, he would have a hard time getting things through until they would start telling the stories of the Good Samaritan and the prodigal son and all that, everyone everywhere in the New Guinea Highlands and in that 1% of Japan that is Christian or whatever had these to transact. They sound very different depending on where you are, and yet you are reimagining in the light of it. Number four, and this comes a little closer to what I was on, but how do we relate across philosophical boundaries? For example, were there residues of animism and cultural absorption in the northern world? Some years ago in summer, I was teaching in Kyoto on American religion to scholars on the rim of Asia, Malaysia, Hong Kong, Taiwan, or whatever. And they knew much more about American religion than most Americans know. They knew every New England theologian. They knew all that stuff. And there they were, some Christian, some Buddhist, some nothing. And we got to discussing what about picking things up from the climate in which you are, which we always do. The Old Testament is in Hebrew, and the early Christians could speak Hebrew and Greek, and we have the book is Greek right away. It is very different if your text is Greek than if it's Hebrew. You've adapted to the environment of the Jewish diaspora in which you're moving. We do that all the time. We don't think about it. So the one liberal Methodist Japanese theologian says, I'm an Orthodox Methodist, but we're the first family on New Year's Day to take our little joss sticks and put them on the fire the way the Buddhists do. And across the room was a disciple of Karl Barth, whom I quoted, who does not believe in these cultural ties. You shouldn't do that. You should never pick up from the culture. You should keep your distance. Somebody in the room said, how many of you have a Christmas tree? Well, whether you're in Taiwan or Hong Kong or Chicago, you have a Christmas tree, of course. How could you have Christmas without a Christmas tree? Well, you know that Christmas, December 25th, is chosen to supplant a fertility cult, and that Christmas tree is a nice phallic symbol growing up. Okay. How many of you roll Easter eggs? Well, what Christian wouldn't have Easter eggs? I mean, if you've got children especially, you're going to teach them the resurrection, which is exactly the opposite of what an Easter egg teaches you. Why do you do it? Well, where do you get the name Easter? From Eostra, the goddess of the spring equinox. And what we do, we take these things, we're not turning pagan by them, we've absorbed them and put a new translation on them, and they become a part of a Christian story, which is a very delightful thing. You're doing it all the time, but there have to be limits. And I think that's going to be one of the big things we're going to be doing, and they show it to us from the other parts of the world. Syncretism is a technical term for the mixing of religious elements into a mush. And America is probably as syncretistic as any nation known. How often don't you hear people say, after all, we're just in different boats heading for the same shore? Yeah. It's well intended. It's to keep religious warfare to a minimum. But it doesn't solve a lot. But you do pick up from the environment. And you pick up some beautiful things from it, and you have funny carriages with it. One year, the Martys had seven boys in the house, age 9 to 14. We had four of our own, and then an adopted Mexican boy, and two Uganda boys who were stranded in America. And the third floor, which was the constant change because we always took in foster children, has skylights. And our boys were well adapted to being under oak trees with skylights, and they could take any kind of storm or whatever. But the first day we had this 9 and 12-year-old Uganda boys in the house, there was a real thunderstorm. And my wife woke up the next morning, and there were seven little bodies littering our floor and our bed. Why? Because to these little boys, who are absolutely Orthodox Anglicans, nature means something different. And the spirits are talking. It scared the willies out of our sons, who thought, that's just lightning. Well, it didn't make them unorthodox Anglicans. It did make them colored by their environment in a way that has to be sorted out, but is part of what goes together. And in global Christianity, we're running into that every day. Number five, issues of war and other conflicts, Christian understandings and roles. Here again, I think global Christianity gives us a very different view than we would have when we're only setting the rules of the game for ourselves. to the rest of the world, for example, World War I was a religious war. Shia, Sunni? No. German, French, Protestant, Catholic, etc. And we don't usually tell the story that way, but read the rhetoric of that war. Doggerel. Gott strafe England, and God save the king. God this, God that, and God the other thing. Good God, said God, I've got my work all cut out for me. Why? Because these people, all Christian, are shooting at each other. World War II, on which Professor Sitzer has written the book, as a different character. World War I, I think you were out partly to say things have changed, cautious patriotism. In World War I, a book called Preachers Present Arms by a Mennonite pacifist who collected all of these things, for example, showed a pamphlet published by the YMCA to be delivered to every soldier on how Jesus would use the bayonet. You know, to shoot a rifle across is one thing, but the bayonet was another. And a lot of these young men were having real trouble with it, so they had to say how the joy Jesus would have using that bayonet to disembowel a Hun. And you know the Germans were doing the same thing about disemboweling the Christians from here. World War II was a little different because Japan was so heavily involved and the Christianity of Western Europe then was much less Christian. But as they look at the world, that's how we fight each other. An issue of The Economist a week earlier asked, what would the world be like if there were no Muslims? Rod Parsley, an evangelist now, some note, says we have to destroy the destruction of every Muslim. And he wants war that would do that. Suppose he were successful. There were none. This magazine poses. Well, the Crusades were supposed to be Christian against Muslim, but when you ran out of Muslims, Western Christians start burning the cities of Byzantium and Constantinople, and Eastern Christianity, etc. Many parts of the world, Northern Ireland, the Protestant Catholic, you're all everywhere it's going on. Now, that's not a pretty chapter. It gives perspective to help us understand why they wonder where we think we have the credentials to be the arbiters in all this. Meanwhile, we do bring peace. I think the voluntary organizations of American life are great peace givers. When I think of the World Vision type programs and Bread for the World programs, just endless programs which make a real difference in all these ways, and they are peaceful, they aren't always governmental, but they are representative of who we are. So I do think that global Christianity can help us understand them all and help any part of the Christian world from feeling they're above it all. Number 6, God and Mammon. The assets and liabilities of the universalizing of Christian ties to market assumptions. The last year before I retired, I did a tour of our alumni, 5 big cities, with Marvin Zonas, who's an international global economist, about which he knows everything and I know nothing. But we covered that up by hitting our own parts of our expertise. I talked religion, he talked economics. But he talked religion, too. After 5 of these, you kind of get to know what the other guy's shtick is, and his was profound. He came to one side of the stage and he says, I have good news and bad news. The good news is the market has won. Communism is gone. Cuba, North Korea, they call themselves communists. China calls it communist. It's totalitarian, authoritarian, but it's not communist. It's very capitalist, as you've noticed lately. Communism is just gone. The market has won in China, too. Socialisms are gone. All that's gone. The market has won. It was simply won. I told him, you say that 5 more times, he's a University of Chicago economist, he'll get a Nobel Peace Prize, I mean, a Nobel Economics Prize for it, because that's what they give prizes for. I think we have 7 of Chicago, Milton Friedman, George Stigler, George Shultz, who just say the market has won, and they say, well, here's a Nobel. And then he went to the other side of the stage, and he says, but here's the bad side. Bad news for you. The suddenness of that change, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the tearing of the Iron Curtain, and all that. We had figured them out as the other without knowing who they were. I got up every morning, I knew what we stood for because we weren't what they were, and then they weren't there anymore. Religion was still there. 72 years of the most systematic atheistic attempt to do away with faith, Lenin, Stalin, etc. And the morning after it's open, we find that every religious group that had been there, despite rivers of ink and oceans of blood and barbed wire to the moon and back, had not suppressed it. There it was. But he said, now the suddenness of that change came, and he said, we don't have the faintest idea with what intellectual, spiritual, theological, philosophical means to interpret this change. And we were just beginning to get that between 91 and 2001, and now the preoccupation on Islamic and the West, certain kinds of Islam, have preoccupied us, so we've forgotten all about that right now. It's on the agenda if things ever change. But to what extent must we be tied to a particular market? Again, I'm from Chicago, so I don't have to knock the market. But you just live and breathe it, and I'm a beneficiary of a lot of it. But when I hear a theologian of the market economy say that that's the only thing God ever had in mind, I always say, where was God doing from 30 A.D. until John Calvin and the birth of Protestant ethic and all that, or Adam Smith in 1776? There were all kinds of economies, and if the variations of this one go, God and we will find others. But having that comparative basis, I think, liberates us from the notion there's only one way to look at the world. Number 7, the Christian awakening of environmental issues. With the church having a place in so many nations and spheres, are we part of the problem or the solution? I think some of the better news in the Christian world is the recovery of interest in the environment. There's a great deal of front page storying lately about how the 30 to 40% of America that is evangelical has huge, important movements that are asking new questions about the environment. When it first came to be vivid, there was massive opposition. It's New Age or it's pagan or something. Somebody said, no, it's in 9:1 of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and if God created them and we're here, we better think about what we're doing with it. So there are new vitalities here, and here's a place where in many other parts of the world where they don't have resources, we could change, but you could be in Botswana or somewhere where you have to cut down trees in order to survive and eat your food. I don't have a solution on this one, but here's one I think where the Christians of the world are really starting to talk to each other. Number 8, Christian potential in global health issues. This is huge, and maybe one of the better sharing stories. I've spent some time in recent years with the Carter Center in Atlanta, and with President Carter himself, who has worked with medics and with Christians. They'll target a disease and try to have it removed. Guinea worm. First of all, river blindness. 90,000 people, children, per year, lacking the salve on the eyes, grow up to have river blindness and will go blind. They get inexpensive chemicals from Merck, and they distribute through the churches, which are everywhere. And the only places there is any river blindness left are the places where the people resisted or whatever. Now they're working on guinea worm, which is just as hideous. Again, the secular world can do some things, and I think the Gateses and the Buffets and the Soroses can do a lot, and the Rick Warrens are doing some things. But I think here's a place where the health situation of people around the world can help us face things, and we can be part of them. I'm making many of these things sound as if we're doing good stuff to them. I'm also saying that many of the things they bring to us will change us. The relation of Christians to each other and relation of Christians to other religions. That is something you become highly aware of when you become global in your outlook. Although that's getting closer to home too, because the globe has reached the local. Thanks to change of the immigration law of 1965, everything changed. Just in time for the Vietnam people, Cambodians, the boat people. I spent a lot of time up Minneapolis way, and there are 50,000 Somalis in the Twin Cities. I have a niece who's a member of Lord of Life Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where there are more Lutherans than people. And her pastor is a gypsy, and the congregation is Burmese. Many of these groups will settle together, the 20,000 Burmese in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And many of them are Christian, and they're bringing some different customs along the way. The Pentecostal and the Catholic were meeting each other. One of the problematic things, and I think theologically we're going to have to spend a lot of energy in the next generation, is what this means in the encounter with other religions. We're learning what it is to be Christian ecumenical, but globally you're always dealing with people who have other religions in mind. I said I taught at Doshisha University of Kyoto one summer and met with the theological faculty. And we talked so many topics. One of them said, you know, Mr. Marty, I don't think we schooled you very well on our background. All 8 of us have Buddhist parents. Well, okay, that's a very different world than where we take for granted a background. When they're doing theology, they're bringing a very different, what I call, mental furnished apartment to it. And I learn from what they're doing along the way. And then the inescapability of international themes because of immigration, relief, and ethical concerns. I don't have to say much about that. It was implied of much of the rest. Finally, local issues. I've been following. I had to go to press and finish this 3-4 days ago when the Pope was just beginning to come. But all the first stories, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, USA Today, everything that comes to you, would all say whatever else the Pope says, the test for the Catholics is going to be, how's their own parish doing? If you're in Boston, where they closed 63 parishes last year, you are pretty mad at everybody. And you're mad at the Pope if he came, but you're mad if he didn't come to face the abuse crisis there. Because they're measuring by what happened to Boston Catholicism. If the homilies are bad and the priest neglectful, or there is no priest, you're measuring. Somebody said to Pope John Paul II, he, because of the huge crowds, and we're seeing them these days, he filled the streets, but he didn't fill the pews. And the test of everything I'm talking about tonight is, are you able to get them in the pews? That is there some local perception? Remember those 12 Hebrews on whom Jesus spent all his energy to win all the Americans. So I think it plays a great deal. And that makes it more important than ever. And they're struggling. We all know. I know your part of the country. You know mine. Everybody struggles. Today, spirituality tends to win out.
I am not a member of the organized church. I hate institutional religion. I'm not even religious. But I'm very spiritual.
I picture an aerosol spray at that stage. The kind of Christianity that, or spirituality that makes hospice calls and packages and does relief and works for justice is people in 8s and 12s and 20s and 100s banding together and building each other up along the way. I think that's going to be a huge part of what we have to learn from where it happens elsewhere in the world. Overseas study and service helps. I hope that we're students overseas. I didn't get a check with your people today, but I know a couple of them, and they're on the go. And that's so important. When they come back to their hometowns, they've had this world experience, gospel-centered and work-centered. I did a program with President Carter one day and while I was doing this project in Emory, and he told of how somebody in Plains, his town, very pious Baptist, always wished he'd been a minister, but he had a little speech impediment and couldn't do it. I wanted to be a minister. And Jimmy Carter said, come with me and you can be. He was a well digger. When he died, he had provided water, safe water, for 1,100 African towns. He said, isn't that a ministry? It's a big thing. Here's where a talent came along the way. I was in Houston a couple weeks ago, where a Lutheran congregation there is now teaming up, and they're going to dig 11 wells per summer. It doesn't take a lot, and a local church can do this along the way, and it transforms the local church. What's more basic than water to the dry? The theology behind it all? I think Dietrich Bonhoeffer asked the best question yet for the 20th century, and I think it's for the 21st. Who is Jesus Christ for us today? Not who is Jesus Christ. We have texts about that. Who is Jesus Christ for us today? If you're Tanzania or Anchorage or Hong Kong or Peru or Quebec or Spokane, it'll have a very different character, but it finally comes down to it. In that book I wrote about global Christianity, I had to ask what holds it together? Why can you even talk about a single phenomenon? And I was influenced by a Scottish biblical scholar, James D.G. Dunn, who wrote a book called Unity and Diversity in the New Testament. And he said, if you just take the letters of Paul and the other letters and ask, were the early Christians high church or low church? The answer is yes. Were they governed episcopally, presbyterianly, congregationally? Yes. Did they have an atonement doctrine that Christ paid our penalty? Or was our substitute? Or had a victory? Yes. God becomes human in Jesus Christ. Is that because there is the Logos, the eternal Word, taking flesh? Or because Jesus is adopted by the Father, etc.? Yes. In other words, that diversity is within there, in the different cultures along the way. And then he asked, and I came up with a different formula, what did they all have in common? They all believed that the human Jesus is the exalted Lord. And if the human Jesus was disappearing, they would soon be out of the Christian camp into Gnosticism or whatever. And if the exalted Lord disappeared, then you had the human Jesus, the nice guy of the Jesus seminar, and so on. And that's a nice little club, but it's not what people die for and live by. So the human Jesus as the exalted Lord is a way that we get into who is Jesus Christ for us today. And that's something I've heard answered in very different cultures, in very different ways, in ways that teach me, and then they want to hear what we have to say too. I do believe we have time for questions. Good. Thank you. I can see you if there are hands. Maybe if there are more light, I could see more. But if there are hands, and I will repeat any questions. There we go. Thank you. Question? Yes, please. Second row. Yes. All right. The prosperity of the gospel in the global south and elsewhere. Let's start by saying its roots were very good, in that many of the people taken to it have nothing. And to hear that God cares, God is generous, though he was rich, yet for your sakes became poor, so that through your poverty, his poverty, you may become rich, doesn't have to be applied to dollar signs, but it does suggest that a beneficent God cares about the material world. Back to the crack I made about spirituality, that Martin Thornton, I called him ornery. He's always ornery. He says, everybody wants to be very spiritual. Oh, it could be spiritual, spiritual. He said, Christianity is the most material religion there is. You can't even get it started without a loaf of bread, a bottle of wine, and a river. So they're picking up that God cares about the material world and our world. Where it goes wrong is in this kind of transactional sense that there's a direct tie between your form of piety and the energy you put into it and the blessing. And for me, it's a little bit like the lottery. Somebody wins. You know, the buses go to Harrah's and Lake Tahoe, and one of them comes back having won $2,000, and everybody thinks that's how it works. It isn't how it works. The others don't. And so I think any theology in which you have a kind of that guarantee implicit, and then how do you justify, explain failure? Poverty becomes a sin, etc. So I think that's it. Like all these things, I don't think wholesale condemnation is in order. You have to get the background. And again, I've seen some. My wife and I have 11 projects in Guatemala. And it's Opportunity International, one of these micro-loan things, where, every time we give $600, you're putting someone permanently to work in a poor world. Last year, this one group alone, and there are some 80 such groups, put 133,000 people to work. And our little $600 at 11 different places, we go to Maria, who makes tortillas, and she got a little loan, switched from charcoal to butane, and is able to employ two more people. And it's beautiful to see. And we have a mattress maker, we have a furniture maker, etc. And they're all fortified by faith and covenant. My wife's in a project in Bogota where 10 American women lend to 10 Bogota women, and if one of them goes down, the other 9 support. The repayment rate to Opportunity International, and it's just typical, in 2 years is 92%. The women's covenants are 100%. And it is beautiful to see the dignity, the taking over. And if that's prosperity gospel, I'm trying to say there's a good side to it. The problem comes in the assurance and the guarantee that the properly thought, properly prayed for thing will automatically produce these results. That's where I think we have to draw a line. Anybody else? Please. How is that tied to liberation theology? I think liberation theology addressed some of the same things in a very different way and was of a great help at a certain stage, but I'm not sure how long it lasted. The liberation theology in general, there's very many different versions of it, but in general, the kind that was very strong in Latin American Catholicism in particular, encouraged by some archbishops, discouraged by the Pope in the end, combines two things. I would call it Marxian analysis, Karl Marx. Not the communist solution, but the analysis of why is it that power accrues to the few and all the rest of you are just working and nothing happens. And then the religious side came in and said God has a preferential option for the poor. Anytime you're deciding and there's somebody on the short end, look at the Gospels, look at the prophets, always the poor. I think this was a tremendous boost on the shorter term. In nations, for example, where the economy was land-based and 3% of the people owned 90% of the land and weren't going to yield, and to have these militant movements, again, some went over the line. I'm a nonviolent person. Some went over the line. It was violence, and that's part of what hit it. But what's interesting to me is I think they made their theological point in a lot of ways. I saw an ABC program once when Pope John Paul II was in Lima, Peru. And in the morning he talked to the bishops and the priests and he blasted liberation theology. You know, we don't need that, etc. In the evening, he's sitting out in a playground next to a guy with a Detroit Tigers baseball cap. They call him Detroit Red, Father Detroit. They're sitting there and a little child runs up and jumps up onto the lap of the priest. Okay, and the Pope blesses him, and he runs away, and the Pope said, but it's supper time. Why is he here? It's not his night to eat. He gets to eat every other night. Well, I mean, the Pope is very sympathetic. He did a lot, by the way, for Third World in this. And I think they pick up the positive side of liberation theology, but when it got into the violent stage, there was a lot of backing off. Way back there, please, and then here. I don't think God cares at all under what auspices somebody gets the well dug. I mean, if it's God's world, God puts rain on the just and on the unjust and so on. And very often in the scriptures, it's somebody who isn't an insider who is the one who is doing the works of God. I celebrate it. And I'm as happy if Gates and Buffett do this on humanistic terms, I guess I'd call it. I'm not going to ever measure all that. But I was asking, what are the pluses you get? First of all, if one-third of the human race is Christian and they do it, that's a big thing. I do think that the modern volunteer movement is pretty well born originally in Northwest European Anglo-America and is behind even many of the secular groups. Wouldn't have been a Red Cross had there not been these other agencies. But also the delivery system, again. The Carter Center counted some. Dr. Bill Fagey, he's from the Northwest, maybe from around here, was head of the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. And in India, when they were trying to get the last measures of polio gone, what did they do? They worked through churches. He had a board. Last time in that province, there's a case reported. Bing, off it goes. And in Africa, that's the big difference. They'd like to do the same thing in the northern part of Africa, in Islamic Africa. But it's harder because it's a village religion, and you can't connect them quite the same way. Whereas these missionary groups and these Pentecostal groups and Catholic and Protestant and so on could. So, again, the theology is not in whether it could be the works of God, whether it's done by the Christians or not. But the theology is, let's use the Christian resources. It transforms the person who does it, and it greatly adds the measure of resources. Okay? It was over here I saw one. Yes, please. Okay. The question was with the power of the Holy Spirit in the actual acts of healing, and what I observe, or what we observe, I don't get everywhere, I read what others do, and how to reckon with that. I'll start by saying something that a great 19th century theologian said: we should never in advance describe the limits of what we can believe and what the Spirit can do. So I'm not going to go around, put a label and say that one's authentic, that's inauthentic, and so on. There's a lot of fakery can go on, but I mean, I've been in many a setting where this seems pretty obvious, and I've been involved with some centers for the study of what part prayer plays in it. So I'm not interested in putting premature clamps on. The danger, I think, comes in when there's a tie, same as with the wealth thing, when there's a tie that if you've spoken in tongues and you've prayed for the Spirit, etc., and you're not healed, the question is, have you failed God? Are you a bad person or whatever? So I would just say, look for the Holy Spirit all over the place. I would do all the healing we can do through medicine. And if somebody experiences more than psychosomatic change, be glad. We don't have to be in the other business. Avoid exploitation. Encourage experiment. I like town and gown. I like being on campuses. I like it when Christian college invites in the community. I see or some trustees have been here, so I've been behaving much as I can. But I've cheered through the experience of not only Jerry Sitzer, but the word about this college is national now, and cheered by its products. And I learned today that you flood the seminaries with graduates, and that's good too. But I'm just happy if I hear there's some well diggers too. Thank you.